Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you walk over the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
Interesting. Did I ever tell you I was in? I came this close to signing up with Om Shinrico.
No.
It was like they were offering yoga classes in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
and there was this nun that was signing me up, and I was about to write them the check, and I just had some last minute questions, and I asked her, like, why is it, because he was really interesting. If you read his books, he had all these books that were, like, published on newsprint, basically, really pulpy stuff, that was about UFOs and meditation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of stuff about UFOs, and so I was like really interested in taking his Kundalini yoga classes.
How long ago was this?
This was in, well, it was in the mid 90s, I guess. And one of the books was talking about how you don't, how one doesn't bow down to an elephant or an image of an elephant or something like that. So I was asking the nun, well, why is it that we bow down to the guru then?
Mm-hmm.
And she just flipped out on me and she goes, guru is not an elephant. And she was so upset that I decided, I stopped writing my check and I just left.
Oh, that was the tip off, huh?
Yeah, but then it was like two weeks later that Guru was on the cover of Time magazine.
What's his name?
Shoko Asahara.
He was on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, because like 2 weeks later was the sarin gas attack.
Huh. Somehow he's passed me by, this guy.
Oh, yeah, Om Shinrico.
Yeah, it just passed me by, but I remember the sarin gas attack. Yeah.
Oh, you got to check him out. He's a trip.
So, what was it that drew you to that particular?
Well, they just put up posters around Upper Manhattan where I was going to school that said, yoga classes. Come to yoga classes. And so I was going to, it was Kundalini yoga. And at the time I was reading about the, I was first reading about the Kundalini, and it sounded like, oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Here you can go and get your Kundalini raised by this guy.
Right.
So that was the sales pitch.
Yeah, which, you know, that could be a euphemism for. Well, this has been emerging through the podcast recently, with various sort of coinciding conversations, is that being anally raped is possibly a ritual means of awakening the Kundalini.
Yeah, and isn't there something about that with boy children, about the key or something like that? There's some sort of, they have Solomon's key.
The key of Solomon, yeah.
Yeah, so, I heard about that somewhere recently.
I heard about it recently too, even though it's not a recent phenomenon, and it's not a recent disclosure either, I don't think, but I only just heard about it. Yeah, there's a certain Judaic sect that practices that on the male children. So, Kundalini, and it was made me think of Jung, because Jung wrote about both. He wrote a book about Kundalini yoga, and he also wrote about UFOs, of course. And there does seem to be a correlation between the two, right? The Kundalini and the UFO, this kind of soul energy or life force.
There was this also interesting thing in Jersey City. When I was living there, I found out that there was a Gnostic bishop in Jersey City. And I was sort of excited because, you know, I've always been into the Gnostic texts and whatnot. I guess back in college that I started reading the Nag Hammadi books and so forth. I took a class in Christianity, and they laid the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip on us. And then I got really into the Pista Sophia and so forth, and even learned Coptic. So when I moved to Jersey City in like 2003, I found out there was a Gnostic bishop there, and I got in touch with him, and we met, and it turned out his wife was taught Kundalini yoga, and I asked him if. And this was like much later. I wasn't really interested in that, but I asked him, was her Kundalini been raised? And he sort of just cleared his throat and changed the subject. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of curious about this guy because he turned me on to this whole network of these sort of like Freemason, Gnostic, like renegade Catholic bishops. It sort of reminded me a little bit of what Lavanda turned up. You know, have you read that stuff, Peter Lavanda stuff about that? There was that group that was making bishops, like, that were really undercover operatives in the 60s, and there were a bunch of these bishops were running, like, front churches that would move funds around for the CIA and stuff like that.
Were they Jesuits or what were they?
They were, there's this thing, it's like something like the primordial Catholics or the original Catholics or something like that. They're this kind of trying to be more Catholic than the Catholics kind of.
Yeah.
And they're not really affiliated with the Catholic Church. I think I forget what they're called, like primitive Catholics or something like that. But they have their own set of bishops. And this Gnostic bishop that I met had been ordained from this lineage, and also been ordained as a bishop from this French prophet, Gnostic prophet, who'd had a direct revelation. And so it was very strange. And then this guy was connected to this other Gnostic church in New York that actually had my band out to play a concert for their congregation. And they were called the Alexandrine Gnostic Church. But anyways, the two Gnostic bishops that I'd become acquainted with, they had a falling out. And the one from Jersey City completely disappeared, and apparently had absconded with the funds of the Alexandrine Gnostic Church. And so there was this weird, like, I got to witness this sort of weird schism in the underground Gnostic trans-Hudson world.
So, but you were participating? You were a member of it? Or
No, I never joined. I was just like... I went and had coffee with the one bishop one time, and then he came over to my house one time, and we just would like chat and talk about stuff, and he was into all these weird esoteric meditations and things like that, and so we were interested in a lot of the same things, so he would come over. We basically hung out twice, and then through him, I met this guy who was running the Gnostic Church in New York. And then that guy had our band come out and play, because Fist of Kindness did a album based on the Pista Sophia.
Right.
The 13 Repentances of the Pista Sophia.
So this is after you learned Coptic.
Oh, many years after. This was like decades later. Mm. And so we did like... They had some sort of... party or something like that, and we were the entertainment.
Right. What kind of party?
Bringing, well, it was like they had little store-bought cookies on plastic plates, and people sort of stood around. It was like the kind of thing that you'd have, you know, at a small Urantian church or any kind of church. Right. You know, a little Methodist Presbyterian gathering, and like if you can imagine like a Presbyterian gathering in China or something like that, you kind of imagine it being like this, like where it has a feeling of being not established,
right,
but sort of like a few strangers sort of gathered together with the most tenuous of connections, some kind of you know, there wasn't that much chit chat about religious ideology going on, which you kind of expect that there would have been more. But you know, some people were sort of New Age, and some people were sort of Masonic, and some people were sort of arch Catholic. So it was a weird mix, you know. But these Catholic, these Masonic Catholic Gnostic people that I met, they have a tendency to get like tattoos. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's almost like they're kind of like metalheads who became uber Catholic.
Right. There's a, you know, George P. Hansen, who wrote The Tricks from the Paranormal. Do you know that guy?
No.
Oh, he's interesting. We're checking out. He was the first Luminous podcast, actually, was him. He's written about the UFO. He writes about UFOs and Tricks and Paranormal, and one of the ways he writes about them, and it's a rare case of actually somebody writing about UFOs in a new context, is this role-playing, that people who get involved in UFOs, they're basically role-playing, and then they do it so well, which is the goal of role-playing, that they forget that they're role-playing. So it's just like live-action D&D with UFOs and aliens, and all these grown men and even academics have just got pulled into this very kind of basic desire-ness to create this fantasy reality and live inside it, you know? And I wonder about, actually my wife said this about, you know John Michael Greer?
Yeah.
Because he's a druid, right? And, yeah. And he's also a mason. He was on the podcast too. And, you know, I was a bit wary of talking to a guy who's a mason because of, well, for obvious reasons. I didn't bring it up in the end, but one of the things my wife said about him, because he seems just such a normal, down-to-earth kind of guy, is that maybe he's one of those geeks who was into the Society of Creative Acronyms and just took it to the next level. Say, oh, I'll be a druid, right? And I'll be a mason. And so it just makes me wonder, you know, how many people get pulled into these things for the same reason, you know, in the same spirit. Really, they just want to play.
Well, I think there's... I was doing some research on, you know, Georges Bataille.
Yeah, wait, Georges Bataille was the guy that Kripal wrote about that kickstarted the whole Prisoner Infinity thing.
He was, well, I was researching him for some reason, but apparently he was with a group of, in France, there was a group of people that got together and they really wanted to do a human sacrifice. But they wanted, like, they wanted to draw lots and sacrifice one of their number or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I can't remember how the whole story went, but I remember thinking that this is the kind of thing, it's like this sort of play acting, and then at a certain point, like when you actually do the human sacrifice, it's not play acting anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like he was really interested in, you know, like you were talking about in Prisoner of Infinity, I think some of the things you were quoting were about his thought about taboo and transgression.
Yeah.
And so he became very popular in the 80s and 90s amongst the sort of the Yale-y deconstructionist crowd. They followed Paul DeMond and Derrida. And I had the strong feeling that that's a sort of a crypto-fascist tendency. I mean, Paul DeMond is definitely a crypto-fascist. That there's this... And that it also serves as an intellectual justification for the pedophilia.
Mm.
You know, is this idea that somehow it's this sort of ritualistic play acting that comes up to a certain point and becomes an intellectual context in which the pedophilia becomes like intellectually legitimized for these people.
Right.
And I know I was reading like this guy Charles Bernstein, who's a language poet from New York, who's a very highly regarded academic Stein critic and so forth, and he's always talking about Bataille. Mm-hmm. You know, and within that context of that time of the 80s, you know, and Foucault and Derrida, where they were all talking about this sort of, like, just saying the word transgressive sort of legitimized your work.
Right.
And I really got the feeling, and they came from a sort of Fluxus background, and I got the feeling that the whole thing had this kind of undercurrent of being intellectual cover for pro-pedophilia. You know, and you can kind of see, like, when I was a kid, for example, like, I remember being sort of approached and recruited through Dungeons and Dragons circles, you know, by older men who wanted me to come and stay with them, you know, across state lines and stuff like that.
Really?
So, yeah, so I think you're onto something with this whole, like, connection between, like, role-playing, masonry, druids, you know, swords and sorcery, probably even Renaissance fair and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. UFOs.
Yeah, and this kind of...
But it wouldn't necessarily begin as an intellectual, like, oh, how can we come up with a cover for what we want to do? I mean, it could be that, but it could also be these are unconscious drives, and so people are unconsciously creating the circumstances. It's that liminal space, really, is where if it's all make-believe and pretend, then you can do anything. But then, as you say, at a certain point, you start doing it for real. So they may not even be conscious of it to begin with. But it's those basic unconscious drives of the traumatized libido is trying to create the circumstances, reenacting the trauma, and a less deep level, but still unconscious, to create circumstances where it can get sexual gratification in these transgressive ways. So it may begin as a genuine intellectual experiment just about, you know, taboo and transgression and all of that, and then you know, the drives begin to emerge, and by the time they do, it's too late, and then the intellectual justification is there, you know, it's because they've believed it from the beginning, they'll believe it at the end, and it becomes... the arguments actually become more and more sophisticated in terms of...
Yeah, but isn't it all a bit chicken the egg?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's... I get pretty lost with... I'd never even heard of Georges Bataille until Kripal wrote about him. And it was, you know, looking at what seem to be Kripal's, Kripal seemed to be unconsciously rationalizing something in his essay on Bataille. So if there's this tradition, you know, the millennia-long tradition of rationalizing unconscious behaviors, that, and that is culture, I guess. I mean, we could get very broad stroke about it. Culture is a rationalization of unconscious behaviors and of displacement activities. And it does seem that this is the tradition running through it does seem to be have to do with having sex with children. Like that does seem to be the one of the primary things that's getting rationalized. So then, like, what is that about? Now, what's, as you say, a chicken or an egg thing? Well, the trauma causes the desire, and the desire causes the trauma. That just seems to go round and round.
You know, also in terms of, you were talking about role playing.
Yeah.
It made me think about Dungeons and Dragons or Boy Scouts. Or, any of these things like fandoms and stuff like that, that there are these things, like how much of the of children, kiddie culture is like constructed or built by people who are building it with these sorts of unconscious or conscious urges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of it is built as a sort of lure?
Yeah, like it's coded narrative. The narratives are encoded with the values and the drives of these people, and so then they instill us as children with those same drives. So, it's like rich rite of passage, and it's like there's a concealed element to the fantasy stories, which is the sexual element and the traumatic element,
mm-hmm.
whereby the hero is, and somebody was posting this at the blog, that Homer's Odyssey is about a traumatized hero who comes back and then traumatizes his son. Well, I haven't read it, but it sounded quite convincing the way he laid it out. So it's like that seems to be fundamental part of the initiation, like the hidden element of the hero's journey is that the hero has to be traumatized at a very young age to be instilled with that warrior. So this back to the thing about the Judaic ceremony of raping the children, that was, I was hearing about it in the context of a circumcision, and the idea that circumcision was a way to create warriors, very simplified, but essentially you traumatize the child sexually, very, you know, infant stage, and then that creates the kind of defended, aggressive, defended identity, and the feeling of being persecuted, rightly, of course, because if you if you're attacked as soon as you come out of the womb, basically, that then leads to this warrior sensibility, and even physically, one of the interpretations of circumcision is that warriors can rape women more easily, like, because they've got desensitized genitals. So, yeah.
Well, that fits in with Lloyd de Maus, right?
Well, the funny thing about Lloyd, it does, but except that Lloyd de Maus never talks about circumcision, which is really weird. It's like, apparently. I mean, I haven't gone through it with a tooth comb, but I got a reader who is very preoccupied. I don't want to use the obsessed word because I don't like it when people use it about me, but he's really focused on the circumcision thing, and he said, what's wrong with Lloyd de Maus? I don't trust him. He never mentioned circumcision, which is a fair point if he's writing about historical trauma. Thank you.
best, Will Bell Brown. Excellent, not a whole house, not a pea soup, no bill, no care, no precise, no past.
You know about this whole thing about how, you know, when people become parents, a lot of them go into this. They go into this whole different aesthetic. Like, you know, before they might have been had like this kind of you know, whatever hipster look. Or cool, like trying to look decent, looking good or whatever, being fashionable. And then once they become parents, they go in for this, like, completely square kind of look, you know? Like, you know, this whole Scoutmaster kind of look with the shorts and the socks up almost up to the knees. And, you know, and I'm wondering if this is like, and then when you're a teenager, you go in the other direction, right? You start off in childhood, you're aesthetically, right, like sort of oblivious. And then as you become a teenager, all of a sudden, like, this is cool and this isn't cool.
Yeah.
As a way of differentiating yourself out of that. And if that sort of square, like that whole square aesthetic, isn't... is that connected to the pedophiliac erotic? Yeah.
How so?
Like I'm thinking of these like sort of chintzy little tchotchkes, you know, with the cherubic little children. Made out of porcelain, and they're always like, you know, there's always these things where the like, you know, there's this emphasis on this sort of innocence of the children, but then there's also this thing of like their pants are slipping down, or or they're like they've just gotten off the toilet, or they're, you know what I mean, that there's this sort of like just in the same way that we were talking earlier about how like the fantasy novels and the Dungeons and Dragons thing are sort of, I think, as an erotic lure for the tweens or the preteens, that maybe that there's on a certain level that people are deploying this like super cute tchotchka puppy dog thing as this kind of toddler erotica. You know what I mean? Like, because doesn't that, don't you find that, I mean, that stuff is kind of like creepy in a way. You know what I mean? In the same way that clowns are creepy.
But what's specific? Because I'm not sure. I don't know these people with shorts and socks up to their knees. Like, I got you. I was with you with the, to begin with when people become parents, they become much straighter and more responsible and more, and all of that stuff, obviously. And that would affect their dress sense. But I couldn't make the connection to them dressing like Boy Scouts and stuff.
You know, Mr. Rogers, for example.
Right.
With his, like, land of make-believe, with the puppets. That whole aesthetic, you know what I mean? That aesthetic universe, in which I would also include, like, a sort of Norman Rockwell feeling.
Mm.
Or there's these, like, for example, there's these little ceramic bunnies called My Blushing Bunny. And the bunnies are doing various, like, tricks with each other. And or then there's these kind of, like, the Hummel figurines. Do you know where you have, like, a little boy in lederhosen, you know, and a little girl, and there's always these things. If you notice on this, in this aesthetic universe, do you sort of get the aesthetic universe I'm pointing at here?
Yeah.
And there's this constant emphasis on like the, you know, you can always see up the little girl's skirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or the boys like that, or like the Coppertone Girl, where the dog is tugging down her bikini bottoms.
The famous ad, you know.
Yeah, was, you know, or the, you know, the boy is like turning around as his pants are being pulled down, or like there's this weird, creepy, erotic undertone to this whole aesthetic, which I think like I've been noticing for the last couple of years, and I feel like it's almost like it's very difficult to call people's attention to it.
Right, because then they think it's you, that you're the creepy one.
Yeah, and there was this, I guess this show, Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I've been watching it.
You know, where he's this guy who's got this invention, which is this toilet that talks to his toddler.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
And I think they nailed that aesthetic in that little bit, where this toilet is saying, "Oh, it was a big poop," you know, or something like that. And it's,
well, give it to me now.
Yeah. And I just like, I don't know, I just wanted to not, I don't really know, like that there exists that this whole aesthetic universe, you know, that I think we studiously ignore, like, because there's something just so ugly about it, first of all, and then a little creepy about it, but that we don't feel like we can legitimately call attention to its creepiness without calling attention onto ourselves or without becoming suspect. house, but that it's there. You know what I mean? And I think it's that element which has led to this now widely acknowledged the creepiness of clowns, for example.
Right, which is supposedly used in MKUltra, like they dress up as clowns sometimes. Which would, you know, be a literalization of that, that the supposed innocence is a cover for dastardly, designs, which I think is, I mean, that's what you're describing and what it is, right? It's this harking after a lost innocence. And this trying to recreate a lost innocence, it's like the Puritanus is connected. You know, the Puritanus is the man who, the boy that can't grow into a man because of sexual trauma. That's kind of more concealed and it's romanticized in Peter Pan and whatnot. That's the same thing. I think these adults dressing up like kids, one way or another, whether literally or just in terms of trying to have that persona of being a nice, upstanding Mr. Rogers guy that's totally fake. That it's like that attempt to recreate the innocence that never existed. Again, it's what the unconscious drives behind it are really, they're trying to resolve a trauma that caused the loss of innocence, and then that becomes the drive to actually to reenact to inflict the trauma on others.
Did you read this book called The Enslaved Queen?
No.
It's this woman, I think Hoffman. Her name is Alice Hoffman, or something like that. And she's talking about her being raised up in one of these cults throughout the, I guess, the late 50s, early 60s. And she's coming up in Queens in a Jewish neighborhood. And yet she gets shipped off every weekend to be brutalized by Joseph Mengele at this, like, underground compound in Long Island or something like that. And it's just the most out of control sequences that she comes up with. And this is nonfiction. You know, this is stuff that she's dredged up in therapy, where Mengele is like, dressed up on like some sort of some sort of clown outfit or something like that on top, but then he has no pants on, you know, or he'll wear like animal outfits, you know, but with, you know, crotchless animal outfits, things like that, it's just the most insane book, The Enslaved Queen.
No, I have not heard about that.
You got to check that one out. I wonder if I thought I might have it right around here. It says, in this one he's naked on the bottom during teaching times, but wore a tuxedo with tails on top or a devil outfit. That's Joseph Mengele in this book here. And this is published by Karnak Books, which is a...
Yeah, I know Karnak.
Yeah, they're like an academic, psychological, professional,
yeah,
psychological. And this woman, Wendy Hoffman, she was like one of the people who came out with this. She was one of the, like, she was really talking about dissociative identity disorder back in the 80s in New York. And then the woman, her analyst is this woman, Allison Miller.
Yeah, I've been in touch with her. She's in BC.
Yeah, this is an insane story.
Yeah, it looks like it.
But she was actually being tortured by Mengele, as it's out.
Yeah, well, Anne Diamond's brought up Mengele quite a lot.
Did you ever read this one, Dinner for Afraid, Betrayal?
I haven't read it. I feel like we had it. I certainly. Oh, maybe. Yeah, I got it from the library, so I did read
Yeah,
some of
it's
it.
really interesting too. But I just think this book is just insane because it's like I never read anything so out of control. Just like and then so couched in like within. I mean, talk about transrealist. This is this is like, I mean, I don't see, you know, talk about truth is stranger than fiction. I don't even know if anybody would dare write a fiction of this sort. You know, it wouldn't work. It would just be too incredible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it seems like you'd have to create an alternate future, an alternate present to present events of this kind in a way that would be plausible, right?
Yeah.
So that is the cognitive dissonance of this material, and I was just listening to Ethan Hawke, and whenever I listen to Celebrity, I get cognitive dissonance because I know that the world that they're in is this world, you know, the MK Ultra world, and yet it just doesn't seem possible, right? Doesn't seem possible that this stuff is going on that you're talking about in this book with Mengele dressed in devil tuxedos and all the rest of it, you know, coexisting with the world that we just walk around in every day and just take for granted as being what it is. It's incomprehensible. I mean, I end up referring back to more philosophical models and spiritual models, as you know, that reality as we think of it is an illusion, a perceptual illusion. And this is why somebody like David Icke is so successful, because he manages to create a coherent narrative out of the whole thing, and it satisfies people in terms of reconciling that tension. But of course the price of that is you end up with something like shape-shifting reptilians, and it's not a good solution.
Well, I mean, I've been doing a lot of research about this, and I was one thing that is sort of been leading to me is the idea that it has something to do with the split between like the aristocracy and common people. Like when you look at any narrative about European aristocracies, you see that siblings killing each other, incest, all this sort of stuff is the norm. You know, it's really pretty normal what they do, and it has to do with the power that's involved and the way that they live as predators on humans, you know? And then that there's this alternate universe with which they coexist, which is that of the commoners, in which they have a whole different morality, like Nietzsche would call the slave morality, which they belong to and believe in. And they have a whole different perceptual world, a whole different world of information that they swim in. And that what happens is, especially like, I guess after the 30 Years' War, and then up to like the mid 19th century, and the age of revolutions, then you get these Masonic groups, which are a kind of cross pollination, and like a lot of these. For example, a lot of these Prussian and German groups, they send off, like, I guess the younger sons of the nobles might go to Texas or Michigan, right, and set up colonies out there in the 19th century, and where they could do whatever they want out there, you know. And then this show up continue to be like Texas and Michigan, continue to be like these centers of this kind of activity up until the 20th century. You know, where you see what happened with Whitley Strieber, or you see up in Michigan, you have Kathy O'Brien, you know, and the whole, like, Purple Gang. Like, that's where they had all this generations of child pornography going on and stuff like that.
The Purple Gang?
Yeah, it was during Prohibition, you know, you had different mafias in different places. Well, in Michigan, they had the Purple Gang is what they were called, but they were famous for, amongst other things, producing a lot of child porn out of Michigan was where it happened, you know, and that was their thing, and that's the context that Kathy O'Brien talks about her story coming out of. You know, is that the CIA, when they were looking for these populations with histories of abuse, you know, that had this, whatever they said, like they chose monarch because the monarch has this kind of genetic memory, you know? And so with the MK Ultra, they chose these populations of people that had lineages of traumatization, right? And so one of these groups were like the people who immigrated from Germany in the 19th century who ended up in Michigan. And there's also a lot of these people immigrated to Texas. And then you see like in Texas there's... So anyways, the aristocracy supposedly goes underground, right? At the around the time of World War One or before. It's supposedly... like the bourgeoisie takes over. This is the narrative that we're all taught. And the aristocracy is sort of just, you know, becomes this sort of appendage, you know, this sort of like appendix that no longer has any real political importance, but they sort of just still exist as a vestigial appendage of our body politic, yeah. You know. But if you read this, like there's this book by Arno Mayer, who's this Princeton historian, he wrote this book called The Persistence of the Old Regime, where it shows that what happened was that the aristocracy just co-opted the bourgeoisie into a sort of buffer. Like they raised up the haute bourgeoisie, ennobled some of them. They certainly made they created this investment banking class, for example. You know, and they create this through these various like secret societies and secret orders and so forth in which you get initiated into them. And that a lot of this was about this political control. And staying in the shadows, you know.
Mm.
I guess my sort of research into the genealogy of this disorder that we're talking about, this like dissociation between this like sort of nice, cute world that we're supposed to live in, where we sort of muddle through, although there are some bad apples, and the sort of maybe more like Dave McGowan world, or the world of, you know, that you're talking about, that we discover as we research into this stuff, is like the world that these of the power structure of these aristocracies, where they have to create these sort of traumatized, dissociated minions that they can control through these hierarchies, you know, these sort of secret, hidden hierarchies.
So can you talk about this with people generally?
Let's see. I would say that, like, there is some way into it in everybody's experience.
Mm.
You know? Like, I mean, in America, you know, that you have these various, you know, there are always things breaking out. But then they're always kind of plowed back under, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, you talk about Jimmy Savile, and here, you know, I mean, like, you have the recent Occupy thing where they bring up the 1%, you know, and there's this constant, like, everybody here is aware that there's this vanishingly small proportion of people who control the whole game, and that there's this sort of pretend democracy going on. But I, as far as putting all the pieces together and saying, like, you know,
I think there's plenty of narratives out there, like I say, from David Icke on down, that address this material and try and present it, or this interpretation, or this reality, but it seems that they generally do a disservice to it one way or another, because they do it in such a way that the illusion stays intact. So, for example, conspiracy theory, more and more I'm seeing, is completely different from social engineering. Because conspiracy theory has this idea of groups of people who get together in secret and plot stuff and then implement it. And that isn't how social engineering works. That's an aspect of it, but that's like the difference between, you know, a crack deal in the ghetto somewhere and Iran-Contra, you know, CIA cocaine kind of thing. Like, the conspiracy theory of people plotting in rooms is so low level as compared to social engineering, which has gone on for thousands of years and has, you know, works internally. It works by generating the values and the ideologies that then control us or you know, shape our behavior. So there's that, first of all, the nuance of that, like, that it's inside us, not outside of us, the internal 1%. And then the other thing, which maybe is the same thing looked at differently, is that it's not, I mean, these people aren't sitting together in some room somewhere smoking cigars, they're walking among us, right?
I think, I mean, the reason that there is so much conspiracy theory is because, well, it's because that there is this manufactured narrative about the world that we're all kind of fed in school and that we're fed through the media and, you know, through magazines, the New York Times, that there's a very, I think that there is a consciously constructed image of the world that the commoners are fed.
You know? Mm.
And it's what, I mean, when you talk about with social engineering to a certain degree, that's like a scientific term for this idea that you, like, if you create for people an image of the world that they live in, then they'll react according to that.
And then they create the world that they've been incepted with.
Yeah, and so what happens is that people realize that some aspect of this engineered reality is false, and that reads as they've come up with a conspiracy theory.
Mm.
You know, they say, well, it doesn't matter, you know, who we vote for, that this, you know, pre-chosen candidate is going to end up, you know, or if we do vote for some outsider, then they get in there and they end up acting like every other mayor we've had or every other city councilman we've had, you know, and they, like, they see these things happening over and over again.
Yeah.
And one way to react is that you come up with this sort of theory of why it happens like that, And these are what we call conspiracy theories, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're just like the natural reaction of people to, well, this false cover story that we're all fed in school and that comes across through the media, Time Magazine, whatever, you know, I guess there's the only way that you can keep believing in it is just by staying inside your house and never leaving. You know, but then people do go outside their house, they talk to other people, and they realize that this worldview is false, and what they come up with in reaction are kind of hybrids of what they've been taught plus what they found out. And I think those hybrids are what you call conspiracy theories.
Yeah, that's right. It's using the same thinking to try and get out of the thinking that they've been programmed with. So it's like, it's the thing, it's perhaps too easy metaphor, but it is easy as the Matrix metaphor. So people are starting to wake up in the pods. Well, the Matrix has to shift the elements of the dream reality to prevent the awakening. So it's got to represent, like, the feeling that people have that something isn't right and something isn't, that nothing is what it seems. That feeling has to be represented by the culture in order to prevent people from actually rejecting the whole thing. It has to keep reshuffling itself. So it does seem to be happening, and I mean, it seems like that however many times people see the most basic trench level that the political system is corrupt, etc., etc., they carry on voting. So they carry on hoping. So somehow there's the disillusionment thing is going on because it's inevitable. They can't maintain the same narrative indefinitely. It has to keep mutating. And so there's disillusionment. It's constantly happening because we know at a bodily level that what's what? We know that we're being lied to at a bodily level. So there's that. And so then to balance out this constant disillusionment process, there are new engines of hope, like how to regenerate hope so that people will keep, because we have such a basic survival, it's almost a survival level need to cling to some hope.
Mm-hmm.
That as long as it's not too tenuous, you know, as long as it's sufficiently new. It might be old new because they recycle the old narratives. Like space is the most obvious thing. Like space colonization was a big hope in the 60s, and then there was disillusionment around it. Now we're at this weird thing where the people don't even believe that we went to the moon, a lot of people. But the hope in space colonization has been rekindled. It's like it's got its second wind now. So, and of course the hope of heaven, you know, the basic religious hope is that all good children go to heaven, no matter how traumatized they are, kind of thing.
Do you follow this guy Corey Good at all, or David Wilcock?
I think David Wilcock, isn't he Project Camelot, that guy?
Well, no, they're actually enemies, but they're like, they started off being, you know, all these little inter-Niacene feuds, right? I think David Wilcock came from Project Camelot, or he was given some exposure there, but now they don't talk. Yeah. Or they talk bad about each other. But this guy, Corey Good, is from Texas. And he's come out as a whistleblower against the secret space program.
Right.
And he's been contacted by aliens who are specifically... they're called the blue avians. They're tall blue birds, and which is interesting because of Project Bluebird, right?
Right.
But his story is that they're that basically there's these sort of good aliens that have come to help us get out from under the thumb of our oppressors, right? And it's it's a great, like, he's got this great all-encompassing narrative. And it's like, it's, yeah, it's exactly one of those things that, that is so attractive because it gives you some hope, you know what I mean? That, well, that the Space Brothers will help us out of this situation, you know, or you think about, like, in terms of the political process, people are very disillusioned, and now we have Bernie, who's giving everybody some hope, and then Trump on the other side is giving people some hope that they can, like, from either direction, that they might be able to get out from under the rule of things as they normally are, you know what I mean? And then it's like, it's all through my life, there have always been these different things, you know, that you can latch onto as being like, oh, this is going to save us, you know? Like, they're provided for you as part of the diet, you know?
Mm-hmm. Bread and circuses.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, because the hope is it's deferred, right? You're deferring. You're always deferring to the future, but it provides something in the present, which is entertainment. Like, a hope is a form of entertainment, really. It's like, it distracts you from the present.
Oh, yeah, wasn't that the first Star Wars movie? It's called A New...
Yeah, The New Hope, right. Which Reagan used that phrase as well around about the time that it was retitled or what have you. That well, you've read that in Prison Infinity, just looking at Star Wars as a microcosm of social engineering through popular culture.
Well, and you look at these, like, these Marvel movies, right? Superhero movies. Like, every single one is an MK Ultra story. It's always about this person who's, like, traumatized and you know, takes on a multiple identities.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
and superpowers. Yeah,
yeah, and the superpowers are different, but every single one, it's like the same story over and over again, and it's more often than not, it's through some sort of secret government project, and every single superhero scenario is always about these like, secret government programs. With advanced technology that you know, transcend the realistic and the mythological, and they're all sort of justifications for covert ops, you know, and it's pretty nuanced. Like, if you see some of them, like with the Iron Man representing the military industrial complex, with this guy who's builds military hardware and is himself a piece of military hardware, you know, or the Captain America, whose very name is like political propaganda.
Right, and yet they're quite savvy, because like Iron Man 3 had a fake Osama bin Laden storyline, Captain America second one, I think, had an Illuminati, basically, he's fighting the Illuminati, and so they've totally taken on conspiracy culture, incorporated into the narratives to stay hip.
Yeah, as if to legitimize, like, you look on these conspiracy forums and they talk about Captain America 2 as soft disclosure, like, that they're saying that this is the way that we're being conditioned for the overthrow of the cabal is through these films, whereas it seems much more likely that what's going on is that this is just more like that they're staying two steps ahead of the populace by, you know, feeding them these various stories and then refining them.
Yeah, I think there's a misassumption that somehow if we're informed, we're that information is power or something, that somehow this stuff is getting out, then we're becoming more aware of it, then we're becoming that's leading to some sort of overthrow or what have you, as opposed to the more paranoid view, which was Robert Shelby, downing the revelation of the method, which is the opposite, right? That's about, it's about getting our consent. The more people are allowed to be aware of the nature of social, you know, hierarchy and the rest of it, and don't do anything about it, the more they're actually consenting to it, as opposed to just being kept in the dark. Because it makes it easier for the controllers, I suppose. I shouldn't say of course, because this is all speculative, but if they don't have to put so much work into secrecy, if people actually are being conditioned to accept it. And because the, you know, the MK Ultra thing, the Marvel MK Ultra thing is, I mean, who doesn't want to be a superhero is the thing. So if this is what the government's doing, it's justified. I mean, it's still, it's, yeah, it's very sort of confused.
Well, it's like when you're talking about, with Whitley Strieber talking about how it's all justified because it's making him more evolved.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, wouldn't the gag of the whole thing be if, I mean, really, it's just making us all crippled and weak, but but that we accept it because we think that we're super, you know?
Right, that is the first part of my conversation with Gary Hype. First couple of songs were by Gary and the last one was by Colour again. I would like to thank donators this week, John, Svatoslav, Daniel, Stephen and Dominic. I don't think I have anything else to say. This is Jason Horsley, The Liminalist, the podcast between, that's Horticulture, AUTICulture.com/liminalist. Thanks for listening. All the world's wretched words, your rest assured that I have heard in smoky skies and infant cries. All of my lies fly high in pride. Fortune and fortune and gold and gold. Fortune and gold, but I feel cold and left alone to sit idly by my graveyard stone. All my thoughts turn into arts, could have been, should have been, whether I'm free or not. All my sadness banished, it's madness, it's vanished and never coming back. My face to the floor, heart racing no more. These lungs I adore have rocked to the core. In my last weakened swallow, my heart becomes hollow as the lens in my mind become fallow. We'll be right back.
or not. All my sadness banished, it's madness, it's vanished and never coming back. My face to the floor, heart racing no more. These lungs I adore have rocked to the core. In my last weakened swallow, my heart becomes hollow as the lens in my mind become hollow. Thank you.